We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. Starting out with local and latest developments on housing and homelessness.
Yes, there was some news this week on housing and homelessness. I want to start out first with the Edmond City Council recently passed, not this past week, but the week before, just kind of sneakily passed an ordinance banning the occupation of public space and the storage of personal belongings in public spaces overnight. And this was clearly an anti-homelessness ordinance. But there was one problem with the city council passing that law. There are no shelters for homeless people in Edmonds. Okay, and the closest ones are in Everett and Seattle. There is a shelter in Linwood, but it only serves women and children, and that shelter is full with a 60 to 90 day waiting list. Okay. So last year, several Washington municipalities passed laws that were anti-homeless, right? For example, both Everett and Auburn passed a no sit, no lie ordinance, and Auburn's actually turned it into a criminal offense to sit down or lay down in public. Now, there are an estimated 450 homeless folks living in Edmonds, and the number could be higher than that. At least 117 of them are students. Currently, the only shelter option within the Edmonds city limits is a very limited voucher program that serves about maybe a dozen people, and that program is currently full. Now, under federal law, it's illegal to criminalize homeless people for camping in public spaces when there's no shelter available. Okay. So the Edmonds City Council is opening itself up on opening the city of Edmonds up for a legal risk by doing this, by passing this law. One council member in the city of Edmonds, Laura Johnson, she proposed that Edmonds build at least one shelter before passing the law, but she was voted down by 5-2. And the fact that this was discussed at the council by the Edmonds City Council members and then rejected just adds to the risk of a lawsuit that the city would eventually lose. So it appears that they understood that it was not federally legal for them to pass this ordinance, but decided to pass it anyway. In addition, it means that many homeless folks will leave Edmonds. Many of those homeless folks will leave Edmonds and end up in King County because Edmonds is, in fact, closer to the King County border than it is to Everett.
It's right on the border, actually.
Yeah, it is right on the border. And here in King County, we're actually trying to provide some shelter and services to the homeless, which Edmonds is not actually doing. And, of course, that means King County taxpayers will end up paying the bill instead of Snohomish County taxpayers or Edmonds taxpayers. Okay, so that was some bad news this week. Also this week, you know, there hasn't been very much reporting on the Puget Sound Regional Council's housing strategy, which was adopted in February. But alongside this report was alongside this, the housing strategy was a report that gives us a really good idea of why municipalities like Edmonds and other outlying areas have large homeless populations. And there are some key takeaways in the Regional Council's housing needs assessment, which is the report that accompanied their housing strategy. Some of the key takeaways from that report are the Puget Sound area is behind in housing production versus population growth. So in the last 10 years, between 2010 and 2020, population in the Puget Sound grew by 40 to 50,000 households, but housing production was about 8,000 to 10,000 units lower than that number. Okay. This has been a major driver of increasing housing costs is the scarcity of new housing. By the year 2050.
And that when there was a very low vacancy rate to begin with.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember back about 10 years ago, vacancy rates have never really been that high, and now they're even lower, and it's even harder to get in, to even kind of look at an apartment. As soon as they're listed or as soon as you see that one's available, chances are somebody's already put down a down payment and is in there. Okay, so also one of the key takeaways is that by the year 2050, Puget Sound is going to need about 810,000 new housing units to accommodate population growth. But currently, we're only building about 4,000 to 5,000 new units per year, which is going to leave us way behind, even if we double or triple that number of new units. Okay. So obviously, that means that density is going to be key. Density is going to need to increase just about everywhere in order to fit everyone, especially middle-income folks. Currently, nonprofits are building housing for folks at the bottom of the income ladder, so those with 30%, those who are 30% of area median income and lower. But the folks who are in the middle, from about 60% to about 80% in particular of area median income, are really struggling to find anything they can afford or anything that's available in their price range.
And that's not new. I mean, I remember those numbers being very similar, like, you know, 5-6 years ago. So at this point, you would think there would be more stuff in the pipeline for those income brackets, but there's not, because
there's not. No,
the county and city have simply not prioritized new housing at all.
Yeah, and it's and just, you know, trying to all get together in terms of the Puget Sound Regional Council to try to talk with the municipalities and say, look, you know, we all got to kind of streamline the permitting process. We need to kind of streamline and find ways to change the land use codes so that people can easily build increased density. That's not really happened, and it needs to happen.
But part of that formula is that our system depends on developers being the primary building
driver
engine, for all this, and essentially having the say, major say, in whether this gets built. And it's the same thinking that's behind the management of pandemic policy. Again, you've got businesses that the governor is using as the primary entity that's making the choices on this, and it's like we're having a disaster in both areas.
And you know, when it comes to changing land use policy, you know, I think one of the hurdles that developers have is that there's kind of a limited pool of places you can actually build, because when it comes to land use policy too, you've got people who are living in a lot of single family homes with decent sized yards in single family neighborhoods that are zoned single family only, who are, you know, they dig in their heels and they're very resistant to any kind of increasing density, even along arterials, major arterials. And especially when it comes to, oh, wow, we love having this new light rail station, or we love having this new main bus route through our neighborhood, but we don't want developers to come in and build apartment buildings. Well, that has to change.
Yeah, that's going to be a losing fight in terms of the light rail stations, because that is very much an engine of gentrification and of density.
Yeah,
and was designed as such.
Well, and the question then is, you know, how do you fight the gentrification too? So that has to kind of be measured in terms of local government policy to try to make sure that people that when a new light rail station goes in, that there's increasing density, but it isn't also increasing gentrification as well.
Yeah, well, the problem, of course, is that, you know, if you are at 30% or lower of median income, there really isn't a neighborhood in Seattle that you can look to for housing.
Well, that's kind of the point, is that housing for low-income people is supposed to be spread around so that We're not creating these neighborhoods that are only poor people live in, you know what I'm saying? You want a mix of housing. That's where I-135 comes in, the Seattle yes. social housing developer.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second.
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. I want to kind of finish the list of key takeaways that I got from the Regional Council's housing needs assessment. So a couple more interesting points I want to discuss on there. One is that only about one-third of households in the Puget Sound region have children. So this idea that we need to prioritize single-family homes centered around raising kids is not necessarily what should be the top priority.
Okay. For decades, literally decades, Seattle, among all major U.S. cities, has had the lowest level of children, of families. Families with kids. And if you look at the enrollment in Seattle public schools, at this point, that is primarily Latino and other non-white students. You know, you're not getting a lot of sort of traditional, you know, 50s households, pasty white Seattle households raising families, because that model simply doesn't exist. You know, the people of childbearing age who live in Seattle or are moving to Seattle, if they can afford housing, it's probably because they work in the tech sector, both parents. And
they're young, and it's a demographic issue. I think young people, regardless of race, are delaying, you know, having families, and they're having fewer children.
Because it's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't, you know, they can't afford it.
Well, and you know, they were raised up in at a time when population density is increasing. And when population density is increasing, it's natural to say, I'm not going to have 8 kids, you know, or I'm not even going to have 4 kids. I'm going to have 1 or maybe 2.
Yeah.
Okay, that's pretty natural.
Yeah, but you're both implying that people's choice to have kids is a very thought out process. When
not always,
time,
but
freaking
not
ass.
Always, but I think for most people it is, particularly when you have a population where women's education is prioritized and women's education levels increase, then childbearing is delayed and the number of children is lower. That's been seen in populations all over the world. That
and
when
that,
the status of women improves, then family size goes down.
And that also underscores the conservative project at the Supreme Court level to not just outlaw abortion, but also to outlaw contraception, because that's coming.
That's all informed by that replacement theory of, oh my God, you know, people of color are going to replace white people, as if, you know, we're not all human beings. Right. Yeah.
A domestic supply of infants is how.
And to ensure the quote unquote white race remains supreme, you know, supremely racist to, you know, that replacement theory, crap. It's, to ensure that the white race remains supreme, we must then enslave our women and make sure that all they do is pop out babies. That's crazy.
Yeah.
And it's also going to be ruinous for the planet, right?
Yeah.
So, and also, I mean, one of the big demographic shifts too is that the baby boom generation is retiring, right? And the baby boom generation, they grew up in those single family households where you have a big yard, you know, and you live in the city, but you're living in a neighborhood where, you know, you got maybe 3 or 4 houses per block, right? That's just not what, the future is going to look like.
Yep.
But that also means that demographically our population is aging, and those folks will not be able to stay in their homes forever. It's much more common for older folks to eventually want to downsize and eventually want to live perhaps a little more communally in, you know, I don't want to say elder care facilities, but in, more like a residential building where you have other folks your age or where you have services available to you as you age. So again, that type of housing may or a housing that looks similar to that structure, but then has people of all ages in it, including families, that is, I think, more the wave of the future and what the region should be focusing on. Now, again, another key takeaway is that when building housing for households with children, there needs to be closer proximity to transit and more transit availability, because kids, as they start to go to school, will need access to transit. Families, if we're talking about surviving the crunch that's coming with climate change, we're going to have to start finding a way for families to get around town without driving everywhere. So that's going to be important. And then the final key takeaway, I think, is that one in three residents in the Puget Sound area works in a different county from the one they live in because of a lack of affordable housing in urban centers. And that's often because of single family zoning. Okay, so that's pretty interesting. You've got like 33% of people who are working, say, in downtown Seattle who live in Snohomish County or live in Pierce County, you know. During the pandemic, that wasn't such a big deal because people were working remotely. And that may continue for that reason. If an employer has one third of their employees who live in Snohomish County and the employer's based in the city of Seattle, those Snohomish County people are not going to want to get back in their cars and drive, you know, spend half hour to 45 minutes, sometimes more than an hour, to get to work and back home every day. They're just not going to want to spend that time.
And Google, which is a major employer in this area at this point, announced last week that they were going to extend their policy allowing people to work from home.
Mm-hmm. I know that the place where I work, we've done that too. And partly it's because we've had some employees who have moved not just outside of the county, but far outside of the county, you know, and for them, you know, getting in the car and driving into work even 3 days a week would be a burden. So, you know, we just have to kind of look at, okay, give them a laptop, get them connected, and they can still be productive, you know. And I think that's going to also be the wave of the future. And I sort of am hoping then that if people are able to work from home more, then they'll be more rooted in their communities. And instead of getting in the car to drive long distances to do their shopping, there'll be more businesses located close to residential neighborhoods providing services directly to the people there. There'll be more parks in residential neighborhoods. There'll be more schools located in those neighborhoods that are easy for the kids to get to. Transit will be a little less, you know, the way it is now where every King County bus route has to go through downtown. and then kind of radiate out. It'll be more decentralized. That's an issue that has to be decided on at the King County Council when they're talking about, you know, funding for Metro, and has to be decided within these agencies like Metro or Sound Transit, or at the Seattle City Council when they're talking about, you know, how do we develop neighborhoods and get people, you know, connected to their neighborhood rather than to downtown. Okay. So then also this week, the King County Regional Homelessness Authority, we talked about this the last week or two, about their budget. Their implementation board voted to pass the budget draft for 2023, which will increase the agency's budget by $90 million next year and almost double it. That budget will now go to the agency's governing board for approval, and the governing board has a lot more politicians within King County sitting on it. So, excuse me, members of the city council in Seattle, you know, members of various city councils around the county, et cetera. But typically the governing board can't make a whole lot of changes. It's the implementation board that could make a lot of changes, and they decided not to. They pretty much kind of rubber stamped it. Once the agency's governing board approves the budget, then it goes to both the King County Council and the Seattle City Council, who will need to take a look at that budget and then determine what appropriations they can make in their own city and county budgets to fulfill the request from the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. Of course, last year that didn't happen quite as planned when the Seattle City Council questioned the King County Regional Homelessness Authority's request for money to fund a high acuity shelter. And then the King County Council instead stepped in and gave them the funding for that shelter.
What is, for people who don't know, what is a high acuity council?
Well, the high acuity shelter was for a shelter for people with special medical needs, and that includes mental health needs. And it was projected to be very expensive to treat a smaller number of people. However, those are some of the homeless folks that seem to generate the most complaints from businesses and neighborhoods who are having to interact daily with homeless folks. It's often the folks who are having, who, you know, you pass on the street, they're sitting in a wheelchair and, panhandling. And, that can be distressing for people to see. You know, they're like, this person needs to be someplace where their health needs are being taken care of. Or it's, dealing with someone, for example, who is having a mental health crisis on a regular basis and you're not sure if they're going to be violent or not, or perhaps they're engaging in a lot of property destruction, that sort of thing. So, that high acuity shelter was high on the list of priorities for the agency last year, but it was a new request, not something that the CEO Mark Dones had discussed with the Seattle City Council. So they were like, wait, what? where's this request coming from? You know, we don't quite understand. And then, the King County Council stepped in and funded it instead. So this year, the CEO Mark Dones of the King County Regional Homelessness Authority, he has ranked the items in the agency's budget by priority level to guide, the King County Council and the Seattle City Council in deciding what they can afford. He's placed safe parking lots. This is kind of interesting. He's placed the money for safe parking lots at the very top of the list. Okay. And I think, yeah, I was kind of interested in that. I'm like, interesting. And I think it's possibly because there's literally nowhere else the agency can get funding for this item, that the federal government would not be providing money. The state government has not provided any money for it. And private sources are not really likely to.
And what is it? Something like a third of homeless people live out of their vehicles?
Yeah.
It's a very high percentage.
Well, of the unsheltered homeless, it's almost half live out of their vehicles. Okay. That's homeless folks who are not already in some kind of emergency shelter or transitional housing situation. So that it is a very high number. But also, too, I mean, the city of Seattle just started SDOT just started enforcing their 72-hour parking limit, which they'd put on hold. They stopped giving people tickets for that and towing cars during the pandemic, but they just about a month ago, month or two ago, started enforcing that again.
And for people who have long memories of the failures of the city of Seattle's homeless policies, a few years ago they tried having dedicated parking areas at an insanely expensive cost. And they got such pushback from neighborhoods that they dropped it.
And
they've not followed up since then.
Yeah, and I think it was largely because of the cost, but also some neighborhood businesses, I think, in particular, were unhappy with having safe parking lots within their neighborhood. But given that when you don't have a safe parking lot, you have people parking right up in front of your business, you know, the city council, I think, needs to really put it to them, or the regional homelessness agency really needs to put it to them like that. Do you want to have a safe parking lot that's nearby, or would you rather have a homeless person camped out right in front of your business? I mean, there's a choice here that needs to be made.
Well, we'd rather they just go away.
Oh, naturally. But that's not happening.
They've got vehicles. They can drive to California.
Yeah. Now,
And I think we can pretty much tell which way the business community is leaning when you've literally got a business candidate sitting on city council that currently has eco blocks surrounding her former business, you know, in Ballard.
Her husband's business in Ballard.
That area in Ballard, specifically the area near the Fred Meyer.
It could be Fremont that actually
Well, it's between Ballard and Fremont.
Okay.
But it's considered Ballard. And that particular area is, her business is adjacent to the Fred Meyer's. And the Fred Meyer's parking lot was where they wanted the safe parking lot. The area adjacent to it. And there was an incredible pushback. And I think she was probably heavily involved in that pushback.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I say, it's the businesses typically that push back against it. And they need to stop that. Or the Regional Homelessness Authority and the City Council need to just say, sorry, no, you can't act like a 2-year-old about this. There has to be a place for these people to go. So, Mark Doan's, when he prioritized the list of items that the Regional Homelessness Authority wants, and he also put pay increases for nonprofit service providers right up there near the top. Again, not something that you're going to be able to get a federal or state grant to cover. A little further down the list were items that could be funded.
And context for that, caseworkers for a lot of these agencies are paid very poorly and they turn over rapidly. So, you know, anytime a homeless person gets a new caseworker, they pretty much got to start over. It's insanely maddening. But the turnover is a serious problem. In terms of creating barriers for people getting into permanent housing.
Yeah, and it's a question of, do you want the service providers to become homeless? Because it's getting to the point where they're not paid enough to afford rent, you know,
here in
Cook County.
And they're very high-stress jobs, too.
Oh, yeah, they are. Now, so that's also very high up the list. A little further down the list were items that could potentially be funded by state or federal dollars. Or other types of funds. So, for example, severe weather shelters, which are great and that we need when it's extremely cold or extremely hot. Emergency response money could potentially cover that. Also the expansion of the high acuity shelter that was funded by the King County Council last year. Mental health funding or funds for addiction treatment could potentially cover an expansion for that shelter. That's sort of in the middle of the list. And then funding for emergency housing, those very important 400 beds that I was talking about last week, daytime gathering places, and funding for BIPOC-led groups are near the bottom of the list. So you look at that and you go, oh, my God, I can't believe that the funding for those 400 unsheltered homeless folks is right near the bottom, but it really underscores how important all of the funding for the Regional Homelessness Authority is. It's vital. And ranking these, trying to decide what's the most important and what's the least important, must have been a very painful process. So. And then finally, I want to talk about an interesting article in Crosscut this week. The title of the article is Seattle's Social Housing Campaign Explained. Okay, it's by Josh Cohen, and it was posted on the Crosscut website on May 26th. You can go find it at crosscut.com. And it has a really good summary of the arguments for and against I-135, the new social housing initiative. And if you're interested in reading the initiative and you maybe want to volunteer to help out, you can find it at www.housingourneighbors.org. Okay, that's the website for the initiative. Now, I hopped on over there to take a look at how things were going on the website, And I noticed that the initiative's been endorsed by several labor unions, environmental groups, and social justice organizations, including groups like 350 Seattle, Choose 180, CAR-W, Community Passageways, Disability Rights Washington, El Centro de la Raza, LILO, the Lived Experience Coalition, Puget Sound Sage, Real Change, Seattle King County NAACP, SHARE, the Tenants Union of Washington, the Transit Riders Union, and many, many others. Okay. Some of the labor unions backing it include the MLK Labor Council, the Seattle Education Association, SEIU, Local 6, that's the Property Services Northwest, United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 3000, and the Labor for Black Lives Collective, Seattle. So a lot of labor groups are lined up for it.
That initiative was only launched about a month ago. So mm-hmm. that's quite impressive for a,
that's
for
pretty good
early
yeah.
in the campaign. Yeah.
And you'll notice some of these groups are part of the nonprofit, the lobbying group that represents nonprofit developers that has come out against the initiative. So for example, El Centro de la Raza is a member of that, pays dues to and supports that lobbying group, but they've actually come out now and endorsed the initiative. So I think that's quite interesting, and I'd like to see more nonprofit developers actually read it, discuss it with their boards, and line up for it and endorse it. Several local politicians have endorsed it too. So state representatives Frank Chopp and Nicole McCree of the 43rd district have endorsed. State senators Joe Wynn, who's up from the 34th district, and Rebecca Saldana from the 37th district have endorsed it. Also King County Council member Guillermo Zahale, Redmond City Council member Varisha Khan, and Seattle School Board members Brandon Hersey and Vivian Song Merritts have endorsed it too. It's also been endorsed by a number of local activists like Colleen Echohawk, Jesse Hagopian, Nikita Oliver, Chikundi Salisbury, and Nicole Thomas Kennedy. Okay. So it's lining up a lot of the local progressives to support it. Okay. And if you've been out and about and trying to sign it and haven't been able to find it, then you need to go visit your local farmers market or come down to the Seattle Center for Folklife, because I'm sure there'll be signature gatherers at Folklife. And you could also visit the website for the initiative, www.housingourneighbors.org, and volunteer to help gather signatures from family, friends, and neighbors for the initiative. So just a quick summation, the initiative would set up a new local agency called a governmental entity called the Seattle Social Housing Developer, and that entity could apply for federal and state and local money to build social housing, or it could once it's started buying and or not just to build housing, but to also purchase property and convert it into social housing. That would probably be the first step, would be to purchase a couple of buildings and start renovating and getting them ready to have a mix of income, people with a mix of incomes live there. Most nonprofit low-income housing only houses people who are, as we were talking about it earlier, who have incomes that are 30% of area median income and lower. That means that the folks who are managing those buildings are not taking in enough income from rents to really maintain the building. Whereas the buildings owned by the Seattle Social Housing Developer would be able to house people with a mix of incomes up to about 120% of area median income. And they could decide within each building, or they could have a set policy deciding on what the mix of income levels could be. So it's a great way to provide housing for folks who are middle income, who are struggling to find apartments that they can afford. But it would also allow the developer, the social housing developer, to bring in enough money in rents to really cover not just the maintenance of the buildings that they own, but to also say, okay, look, we have a pool of cash to purchase more properties, to build more buildings, and they could use that income stream to issue bonds to borrow money, which is not something that nonprofit developers can do now. So it's really a great idea and a great way to expand particularly middle income housing, kind of the missing middle in the housing equation here in Seattle. So I would encourage you to go to the website www.housingourneighbors.org and read the initiative and check it out. Okay, so that wraps up what I have for housing and homelessness. I just also wanted to quickly mention too that both the Seattle City Council and the King County Council will be opening up to hybrid in-person meetings this coming month in June. Starting June 1st, the City Council will be conducting its meetings in a hybrid in-person and online format. And that means that City Hall is going to be open for the public to attend meetings in person again, if you wish. Council President Deborah Juarez made that announcement on Monday, saying that she will be attending in person, but that some council members may choose to join the meetings remotely instead. Wearing face masks will be strongly encouraged, although not required.
Oh, for goodness sake. Yeah. I mean, this is one more message from elected leaders that the pandemic is over, and it's not. We'll get to that shortly.
Yeah, and I think that may be the reason why some council members, particularly ones with babies and young children at home, may choose to not attend in person. The public will still be able to attend online if so desired, and copies of the videos will still be posted to the City Council's agenda website as well as the Seattle Channel website. In addition, the King County Council will resume hybrid in-person and remote meetings starting June 7th, so about a week later. And now I've heard mixed things about hybrid meetings, that it can be very hard for remote attendees to follow what's going on or make comments at appropriate times. And it can also be hard for in-person attendees to hear what remote attendees are saying. It all just depends on the equipment that's being used. It'll be interesting to see how those meetings go once they start up on June 1st. So that wraps up my local news.
When the meetings started going online initially, there was like a couple months there where they were scrambling to.
It was very rocky initially. Yeah. It's been pretty smooth recently, but it was a rocky start for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, summer tends to be a better time to institute those kinds of changes. So June is probably not a bad choice for that, given that I don't think the City Council is doing a lot of really urgent stuff, like they're not working on the budget right now or dealing with other super important kind of changeover things like they do right after an election while you're bringing in new City Council members, getting your committees started up, and dealing with old items that have been put on hold since the prior, you know, budget cycle.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, speaking of elections, there was actually multiple elections in different states, but not going to just touch on Oregon for a moment.
Yeah, which didn't get a lot of national attention. That was Georgia and Alabama primarily. But Oregon had a problem with printing ballots that the print was too fuzzy, and so the electronic readers could not read them. And so there was a delay in counting. But we found out this past week that a seven-term U.S. incumbent in Congress in suburban Portland was unseated in the Democratic primary. He was Kurt Schrader. He was beaten by a progressive challenger named Jamie McLeod Skinner. And she ran primarily on climate change. And there's a lesson there for all the districts around suburban Seattle, which is very similar to suburban Portland in a lot of ways, probably the most similar part of in the country. And, you know, you've got Adam Smith in the south, you've got Kim Schreier in the east, you've got, the Microsoft lady, I'm drawing a blank on the name of the rep in the north, and then in the far north, Rick Larson, and also in Kitsap County, you have all these fairly centrist Democrats, some of whom have been challenged by progressives in the past, some of whom have never been challenged, seriously, from the left. So, you know, for people, progressives who are interested in having, say, somebody more like Pramila Jayapal in Congress, who's a strong progressive, the chair of the Progressive Caucus, in fact, in the House of Representatives, you know, it is winnable. The incumbents have generally a lot of corporate donations. In the case of Schrader in Oregon, he had been endorsed by Joe Biden and took a lot of criticism for his support from pharmaceutical companies, who really don't have a lot of facilities in suburban Portland. So they're not his constituents, but they were bankrolling him nonetheless. So, you know, for people who are thinking about 2024, the time to start organizing for that is right now. You know, it's never too early to start thinking about running in the next cycle.
Never too early to start thinking about running in general.
Yeah. Yes.
All right.
Especially when you perceive threats.
Moving on to this week's pandemic-related news.
Well, the big news locally was that both Governor Jay Inslee and Lieutenant Governor Denny Heck, tested positive for COVID-19, which is sort of, I don't wish the virus on anybody, but it's karma, shall we say, for the state pretty much abandoning any pandemic, restrictions over the past several months, and the resulting spike in cases that we have seen pretty much since March, when the statewide indoor mask requirements were lifted. The case numbers continue to rise. King County's numbers have gone up something like 74% in the last 2 weeks. That's statewide numbers. King County's numbers have gone up about 50%. So it's, the rise is slowing down compared to what it has been, pretty much since mid-March, but, it does continue to go up. And it's now, about tenfold what it was in mid-March, the new case rate. So, again, the pandemic is not over. The CDC this week came out with an advisory, and the state is also echoing this, strongly advising that you wear masks in indoor spaces with poor ventilation, but they're not requiring it anywhere. So, you know, it's up to you. It's up to the businesses. Some businesses require masks, many don't. So,
Yeah, I know my local grocery store doesn't require it. And every time I go in there, there's about half of the folks in there are not wearing masks, especially the checkers.
Yeah. And it's
and I just kind of wonder how many of them have already had it.
And, it's hard to hold your breath for that long.
Yeah.
to buy groceries for a week and, you know. It takes maybe an hour, so good luck holding your breath for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So nationally, we saw a study from the CDC. A very large cohort this is a survey, basically. About 25% of people who, according to the CDC, who contract COVID-19 wind up with long COVID. Now, we don't know a lot about long COVID, the symptoms vary widely. We don't know why particular people get it and other people don't. And we don't know how long it lasts. But it can be incredibly disruptive to a person's life. And if a quarter of all people who are getting COVID are getting long COVID as well, that itself is an argument for pandemic restrictions, because you don't want people getting the long COVID. And, you know, a certain number of people, a fairly large number of people are going to get that, you know, if you have high case rates of new infection. And we, the CDC also made it official this week that the subvariant, which we've been talking about for the last month or so, BA2.12.1 has become dominant in the U.S. Now 58%. It is even more infectious than the previous subvariant, which is even more infectious than the previous variant, Omicron, which in turn was more infectious than Delta, which was more infectious than the original virus. So, you know, once again, cases going up in many parts of the United States, including in King County. So the pandemic, once again, we'll say it again, is not over.
Yeah, and a number of those are reinfections, right?
Yeah, and breakthrough infections for people who had the original two vaccine shots but have not had a booster shot. The level of boosters in the United States among adults is something like 30%. It's relatively low. And those people are all vulnerable to Omicron and all of its subvariants.
And
the virus has learned how to evade the original vaccine.
Yeah, and when I said reinfections, I meant people who have had Omicron in the past, had Omicron or had the original in the original virus and gotten sick and recovered, and or maybe they didn't have any symptoms but they recovered from the infection. They're getting sick with the new variant now.
Yeah.
So again, we're never going to know, because they didn't do robust testing in the U.S.
You know? Yeah. And still are not doing robust testing.
Exactly. Yeah.
And people who are doing the home testing often are not reporting their positive results.
Because where do you report them, right?
Yeah, so.
you report them to social media.
Yeah, exactly. So we're getting, you know, those new case numbers are probably very low compared to the actual numbers out there. Mm-hmm. So on this Memorial Day weekend, you know, the unofficial start of summer, people are doing gatherings, people are doing weddings, people are doing all kinds of social events. You know, take precautions. We're not out of the woods yet.
It's really important to remember that if you're outdoors in a large gathering of people, you're not safe to take your mask off necessarily. Okay. So I know a lot of folks are like, well, I'm outdoors, it's safe for me to take my mask off. But if you have people around you and you don't know their health status, you know, if there's a lot of them, you're probably not safe to take your mask off.
If I were going to a Mariners or Sounders game, I would not take the mask off.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. That leaves us just about 10 minutes left. And let's talk about what happened in Texas.
Oh, my goodness. Where to start? Well, we can start with the basics, that an 18-year-old with an AR-15 walked into an elementary school in Uvalde on Tuesday, shot and killed two teachers and, to date, 19 kids. And this has provoked the absolutely predictable howls of outrage among people wondering when these mass shootings are going to end. Texas, of course, has had more than its share of mass shootings in the last couple of years. There was El Paso, which was a racist shooting at a Walmart a couple of years ago. Santa Fe High School shooting, the church in Sutherland Springs. And, you know, the number of mass shootings with a lower body count that don't get reported in the national media is also very high. And, you know, statistics have shown that states with lax gun laws are much more prone to gun violence and gun deaths than states like Washington, where there's actually a permitting process in place. Texas abolished all permitting for guns over the past year. Governor Greg Abbott has been on the defensive this week because his administration has championed making it easier and easier to get weapons of war, high-powered, semi-automatic and automatic rifles, things like AR-15s, and high-capacity magazines. The shooter in Uvalde had 7 30-round magazines with him. So he had enough to, enough to shoot up the whole school, basically.
Essentially, arming himself for a war.
And
because right? That's what these weapons are. He had two semi-automatic rifles with him. And essentially they're weapons of war. And I feel like the focus right now is on blaming the police for not storming the classroom. And yeah, but no, because who as a police officer in any other country but the United States signs up to go to war with an 18-year-old who has faster reflexes, who is armed with literally that much ammunition and that kind of weaponry? Doesn't happen anywhere else in the world.
And the local police chief has been very blunt about this. These comments didn't get a lot of attention, but he was saying basically we were outgunned. Mm-hmm. Dozens of police officers outside the door did not have the firepower of the 18-year-old inside it.
Yeah.
And that is a condemnation that's a condemnation of political policy. It's a failure of political policy. It's because one party in this country, has, taken gun fetishism as part of its basic ideology. There's nothing that you can say. The arguments are all bankrupt. It's not because we don't have enough mental health services, although we don't. And incidentally, under Abbott, Texas has slashed its mental health spending. It's now 50th among the 50 states, in mental health spending, but he's blaming mental health services.
Yeah. Ted Cruz was approached by a British journalist this week when he was at the National Rifle Association convention, which I find highly ironic that they had their national convention this week when this happened, right?
In the same state, yeah.
In the same state, yeah. And both Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott and their leading senator, Ted Cruz, decided, okay, it's a good idea to attend the National Rifle Association convention, speak there, and defend the sale of the war.
Although Abbott wound up canceling his appearance, he did video presentation. He canceled it in favor of doing a dog and pony show press conference in Uvalde yesterday. That I saw one of the networks was carrying it, broken in the middle of the fact check-in, and the anchor was like, okay, Abbott is not going to gaslight us today, which is a remarkable statement for a network anchor, but,
Well, the British journalist who asked Ted Cruz, why does this only happen in America? And Ted Cruz immediately said, well, I hate it when the media politicizes guns and, the Democrats, blah, 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 which was really interesting because he made that statement and it was Cruz himself who was politicizing it. It was not the journalist. The journalist came right back and said, well, I'm not actually politicizing it. I just want to know and our viewers just want to know why this doesn't happen in their own countries. He was an international reporter.
Care about Democrats and Republicans in our country.
Right. We don't really follow that. We just want to know why it's happening in America, but not anywhere else. And Cruz was like, oh, it's mental health and, ignoring the fact that his state does not have any background check laws that would forbid a person with a mental health history from getting their hands on a weapon of war. And at the same time, also ignoring the fact that the shooter in Uvalde, not a gunman, a gun boy, literally 18-year-old boy, had no mental health history. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
And it was another 18-year-old white male who shut up the grocery store in Buffalo a couple weeks ago.
Just a couple weeks ago, yeah. Another gun boy.
Yep. So, yeah, welcome to America.
Well, I'm going to push back on the idea that the police did not have enough firepower to go in there and deal with this. They might not have had as good a weapon on them. They had plenty of weapons. They had all those cops had additional like shotguns available in their, the trunks of their cars.
Is not the same as a semi-automatic rifle.
I understand that, but they had the numbers. They easily could have like dealt with that. Sure, they probably would have taken some injuries, but that was the entity that was there to take care of that, and they didn't do it. And I'm sorry, but I'm not going to
Interesting, Mike. Well, that the six school security officers who were kind of in charge of the initial response just a couple of months earlier had gone through a training, pretty extensive training, of how to deal with a school shooter. And yet when they actually were confronted with one, the firepower of that school shooter was so overwhelming, it literally kind of turned him to jelly, you know? And I've heard people speak who have been in U.S. wars abroad, right, who have come home and become very anti-war, and they talk about the fear that you feel, and they talk about the way it completely rewires your nervous system. And even though, you know, you may sign up to join the military, or you may sign up to be a police officer, it's not going to be easy to go up against somebody like that.
I understand that, but look at, you had, I'm sorry, you don't get to sit there and say about the nervousness that you're feeling and turning you into jelly while there is literally someone in a building turning children into jelly, okay? They had to, like, get DNA from the parents to identify some of the bodies. So, you know, I'm sorry, that's just complete bullshit.
I want to push back a little bit because you know, the delay in trying to breach the classroom was inexcusable. And, you know, it's gotten a lot of attention. But, you know, the delay in initially going there until you get a tactical team that's trained to do it in place, which should have taken 10 or 15 minutes. It shouldn't have taken an hour and a half. But even in a small town, you know, the border patrol station is literally the next block from the elementary school. If you look at Google Maps, so you know the problem is not just the speed with which an AR-15 you know fires, literally a bullet a second, but also. You know, the velocity of the bullets. It can pierce body armor. It can pierce steel doors. It can go through walls. You know, it's, you know, the shooter was shooting at police through the door, apparently.
And don't forget that each one of those bullets is like a really hard punch. Okay. It's worse than that. You might be holding up a ballistic shield and you've got that kind of firepower coming at you. It's not easy, okay?
No one's saying it's easy. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that the task of them, the primary task of them was supposedly to protect life.
Yeah.
That was the job they signed up for.
Oh, yeah. No, I get that. But like I said, nobody else, no other police agency in the world, no other country in the world do people sign up to, you know, when they join a police agency to literally go into a hail of bullets like that. Okay.
But everyone that signs up in this country.
In this country has to do that. Yeah. And my point is that, that's insane. Okay. My point is that that's insane.
Yeah. It is insane.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not disagreeing with that, and we're over time anyway. I'm disagreeing with the BS line that they're like trotting out that, you know, these guys couldn't have expected to do anything. And that's
not what I'm saying.
I don't think either of us are saying that.
No, I don't think either of us are saying that.